What are you expecting from the Donald Trump administration? Reveal wants to hear from you. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You can also catch all of our shows on WJCTnews.org or through the WJCT app. And just ahead, Reveal host Al Letson is here to ask you, our listeners, what your hopes and fears are under the new presidential administration. Join our conversation at 549-2937. Then later, UF Health Jacksonville paramedics want to train more than 1,000 people to stop life-threatening bleeding. Plus, AARP is helping people over 50 in Jacksonville find jobs. All of that and more is just ahead. But first this hour, when Jacksonville voters went to the polls last month, they were just about evenly split between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Clinton edged out Trump in the River City by 48% to 47.7%. It's just one of the ways Jacksonville is a divided city. And that's what brings Reveal host Al Letson back to his hometown to tap into that divide and talk to people who are either excited or scared about what will happen under Trump. So to our listeners, what do you expect in the next 4 years? Are you happy about it or not? Share your thoughts now at 549-2937, or you can comment on today's episode post on the First Coast Connect Facebook page, or shoot us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Now, Al Letson is familiar to many WJCT listeners as the host of the multi award-winning program Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, which airs here on 89.9 Thursdays at 1 and Saturdays at noon. Al also hosted the program State of the Reunion, and he appeared on WJCT Public Television as the host of Race in the River City last year. Welcome back to Jacksonville, Al, and thank you so much for being on First Coast Connect.
Thank you.
All right. So besides wanting to come back to Jacksonville for the holidays, what brings you specifically to Duval County to work on this inauguration episode for Reveal?
Isn't that amazing how those two things came together?
Yeah. Coincidence.
Seems kind of genius. We over at Reveal, so I work for the Center for Investigative Reporting now out of San Francisco Bay Area in California. And you know, we've done a lot of coverage on the election, and we've been trying to, you know, think about how we're going to cover these type of things. And we began to look at cities that were divided. And the data team, I really had nothing to do with this. The data team came to me one day because they knew I'm from Florida and said, "Do you know Denton, Florida?" And I was like, "I've never heard of a Denton, Florida."
No.
And I'm like, "Oh, well, it's this county that's really divided. Like, the numbers are really even." And they were saying, like, we should do a story on it. And I was like, "Yeah, but where is Denton?" And then they were like, "Oh, it's not Denton, it's Duval." And I was like,
"Okay.
Yeah, I know Duval." So they looked at me like I was crazy when I did. So that's how I ended up here.
Okay, so they said these data people, these mysterious data people came and they said, classified by several different factors, Duval is in the top 10 of...
Yeah.
A divided county. What are some of these factors besides obviously the political one?
I think, you know, it was the political one. It's what's going on here socially with the HRO type stuff. When they look at like immigration numbers, like all of those things, it was a lot of different numbers. You know, to be quite frank with you, like,
please do.
The minute they said, "Do you want to go home?" I stopped listening to all their reasons. I was like, yes.
Okay.
Yes, I want to go home.
Vacation on Reveal. Yes. Got it. All right. So, Al, we both grew up in Jacksonville, mm-hmm. in this area. So I wonder, did you always feel that it was a divided city? Did you feel that growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I love this city. I love this city in a way that I can't describe. It's home. But, you know, home is always a place that's... you know, a mixture of good and bad. And you have like things that don't ring true to you as you grow up, and things that, you know, you love about the place. So yeah, I've always thought that Jacksonville was a divided city. I've always felt like there were places where I was more welcome than other places. That being said, I also feel like Jacksonville, you know, Jacksonville is a type of city for me, you know, and I think that, like, it's when you think about America, when you think about any place, you have to think about it like how it feels for you individually and not pass that on to how it feels for other people. Mm-hmm. But for me, Jacksonville feels like it's a place that loves me and I love it back. And I mean, that's an amazing thing. But I want everybody to feel like the city that they live in loves them and loves them back. And so I think that when you, if you look at it from that lens, you know, we got a ways to go. We got things to work on.
Now, is the division worse now, do you think, than it was when you were growing up, or do you see it getting better?
I think it's different. I don't think it's getting better. I think that the division, I think that when I was growing up, the way that politics played out, you know, and I could be idealizing this, I'm not sure, but it felt like people could have, like, conversations. Let me rephrase that. I think when it comes to the issue of race in the South, we'd never have the conversations that we need to have. So that's one thing. Like, if you just put race over in the corner and talk about, like, just politics, and I know it's hard to divorce race from politics, but if you just talk about politics, it seems when I was younger, like, people were able to, like, have conversations between each other. You look at, like, what happened, let's say when Ronald Reagan was president, I mean, you know, him and Tip O'Neill worked together on things to kind of move the country forward. And so I think that, you know, if you look at the way politics has happened over the years and the proliferation of media, you see that, like, now, like, politics is like sports. It's like, you know, listen, the Jaguars are not a good team and they're still my team, and I'm going to root for them. Yeah. So I think that's what happens with politics as well. So, like, Republicans, you know, generally just go for Republicans, and Democrat just go for Democrats. And I think that, you know, when you're in that partisan divide, like, tensions get, you know, ranked up. And so, yeah, I feel like, in some ways, yeah, we're definitely, the country as a whole is way more divided, I think, than I've ever seen it.
And when we're talking about this idea of division in Jacksonville, I'm wondering, is that always a negative thing, or does that just mean that maybe we're a really diverse city that has different people who all happen to live together?
I think what's beautiful and challenging about Jacksonville is that in a lot of ways, it's like the United States. The United States is really big. And you can go from one state to another and be in a completely different culture, see completely different landscape, deal with completely different people. And I think that that diversity in both thought, people, and landscape is one of America's stronger attributes. But it also means that you're going to have people, you know, clashing against each other. And I think when you think about Duval and Jacksonville, because it is, like, such a big city, you know, I was explaining to the people in California that, like, in Duval, like, you can start the day off in the beach and end the day in the sticks.
Right.
You can start the day, you know, downtown and go into suburbia. Like, it's so when we're trying to bring all those things together, there's absolutely going to be clashes, and there should be clashes. Like, there should be, like, you know, democracy grinds up against each other. And I think that that's good. But I also think that, you know, some of my issues are is that, like, there's just a basic human decency and human rights that we need to think about in having those conversations.
So this divided place that you call home, this is the perfect place to come back and look at how people are reacting to the election of President Trump. And we have a couple of those people on the line waiting to say something. Lewis, you're on the South Side. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, Lewis.
Hello. How you doing?
Good.
Yes. If the question, I'm not concerned about the security and the technological dominance that the United States should hopefully will sustain throughout the Donald Trump's tenure. The recent incident with the drone that China recovered and the comment that Donald Trump made said, oh, let him keep it. I have a concern with that. And that we do not want any aircraft, any drone in the hands of any other country besides the United States, because we have a dominance, and I'd like to ensure the United States sustain that dominance. So that's my only concern about when Donald Trump ignores the briefings and that sort of thing. He needs to get smarter, and he has a lot of good people around him, and that's great. And hopefully he will listen to them.
Now, Lewis, are you hopeful at all about other aspects of Donald Trump's presidency and things that he has said?
I am hopeful in his idea of doing things differently, but in a positive sense, of course. Moving forward positively and breaking the mold of doing things because you're Republican or Democrat, I feel that do the right thing, and that's the key. But however, some things are hard to change. For example, you know, only when a team is is winning that another team player would help the opponent up off the field. But at the beginning of the game, no way. I will not help the opponent off the field, you know, off after they've been tackled. But when they're sure that they're going to win the game, you see all people helping. You know, the opponents off the field when they've been tackled. Well, cause that's a no-no. You won't see that happen. So there's some things that are set in steel that you will not do. Well, Donald Trump, I expect him to break that mold that he could help others move forward and do things positively for the good.
Okay, thank you, Lewis. We have lots of other callers on the line. Thank you very much for calling. And now we go to Tom on the West Side. Tom, what's your question or comment?
Yes, good morning. Good morning. Yeah, talking about how fragmented Jacksonville is. My quick point is I notice when I watch people that everyone's always on their phone or their device. They listen to their own particular slant of the news. And no one's ever exposed to any opposing viewpoint. So everyone's in their little tunnel, and all they get is their own self-reinforcing information, and that's why we're so divided. As for the specifics of the Trump administration, the thing that alarms me is Reagan at least had the sense to appoint an extremely good staff, and Trump's people are a bunch of millionaires with axes to grind and their own political viewpoints, and very little experience. It truly alarms me for our future at this point.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Tom. So Trump's picks for his cabinet definitely getting a lot of people's attention for various reasons, and we'll get to that a little bit. Mm-hmm. What about that point he made about being in your own echo chamber and only listening to news that agrees with you?
I mean, I think he's 100% right. I think that, you know, at the base root of what I think is wrong, I think that the earlier caller, when he was talking about, you know, that you don't help the other opponent or whatever, is that like, and when I said that like politics has become like sports, so we only root for our team,
right.
I wasn't saying that in a good sense. I think that like the problem that we have yet to figure out in American politics, and it trickles down into our communities, is that there is no them or they. There's only us. Like, we're all Americans, and we have to figure it out together. Like, mm-hmm. I don't have the option of looking at somebody who's an American as an enemy because we have different points of view, because we're never going to get forward if I'm looking at them as the enemy. It's totally acceptable that we have different points of view, but like, if we can all remember that we're all Americans and we're all on the same team here and we've got to figure out our way through this crazy world, then it changes it. But yeah, absolutely. We're all living in our bubbles. You can totally, when I did State of the Reunion, we did an episode called The Sorting of America, and it was about exactly that, how communities segregate themselves from each other, mm-hmm. and how that segregation is what leads to the end of society working the way we need it to function in this society, where we have people of all different race, all different sexual orientations, all different religions, you know, ethnicities, like all of that stuff. Like, you can't segregate yourself or else it doesn't work.
Mm. And you're going to be here in Jacksonville talking to some real folks about yep. how they feel about the Trump presidency. So I just wonder, what is it about Trump specifically that the Center for Investigative Reporting thinks this deserves this long-term project? Because you're planning to follow up with these people throughout his presidency, maybe? maybe. So, sure. Yeah, what is it about Trump that deserves this sort of long-term look?
Well, I would just say that, like, this is the first time that we've had a reality star as a president of the United States. And when you think about it from that lens, that, like, Donald Trump made his money as a real estate plus off of his brand of Trump, and that he is, you know, a reality show participant. Mm-hmm. It means that, like, we are in really different territory here politically. When you watched his campaign, it was different from any other political campaign. And I think that that difference, that shakeup, for good or for bad, is what's interesting to us and what we feel like we need to talk about. Additionally, like, I'll just say this, personally, what worries me about the direction that the country is going through, and I'm not saying that Trump has specifically done this, but, you know, not long ago I spoke to Richard Spencer, who was the head of the, or not the head of, but who coined the term the alt-right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're seeing these groups kind of rise to prominence. And so, like, constantly people have written me and said, like, why are you highlighting these people? But I'm highlighting these people because they have they have advocates working in Trump's cabinet or as advisors.
Right.
And if you go through and just look at it, it's there. And so for me, it's like, if those type of people who are, you know, basically white nationalists, not basically, but are white nationalists, mm-hmm. And they have a direct line to the president of the United States, I think that that's something that every American should be concerned about. And every American should say, you know, like, we have rejected those ideas. We may have a whole lot of different issues, but I think as on a whole, the world has decided that Nazism is not good.
I hope so.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, if we can all agree on that, then we can all agree that we need to keep pressure on this president and on this administration to make sure that those voices are weeded out and treated as ridiculous as they are.
And we have lots of calls still on the line. Wells in Atlantic Beach, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And I want to say welcome home, Mr. Ledford.
Thank you.
I listened to your show Reveal quite a bit, and I have to say the welfare check really shed light on how the system works and kind of gives an opportunity for people to see that, you know, it's not welfare queens that are getting welfare money. And the majority of people that get it are white, and some are even very wealthy white people.
Yeah.
I'm a member of the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition. And as far as Donald Trump is concerned, I think the nation needs to begin to really understand the need to organize and the need not to be divided. And he is a very divisive person, and they have to divide us to keep the 99% divided so we won't unite. But I think that is happening on many fronts, like, for instance, Standing Rock, Sable Trail Pipeline, the condition in Flint, Michigan. I think that demonstrating is necessary. It was necessary in the 60s. I'm 70 years old now, and I will be participating in the Women's March in Washington on January 21st, and I invite everybody to come to that march if you can get there. There's also going to be a march in Tallahassee on the same day and in other cities across the country. So I think people need to start to organize. I belong to the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition. I'm also working with Pastor Gundy here in Jacksonville. And I think that it's time to understand that there is a class war going on, and the war is against us. The war is against the 99%. Last thing I want to say is that we have a celebrity who's going to be in the White House, but we also had Ronald Reagan, who was an actor in the White House, and he played his role quite well for the rich who really control America. Thank you again, Al.
I would say that Ronald Reagan was an actor, but he had also been in politics before he became the president of the United States. So just highlighting the difference between Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan, that, you know, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. and had been involved in politics long before he got the top job in the United States.
Now, Al, going back to this show, because you are in Jacksonville working mm-hmm. on an episode for Reveal, and you're going to be looking at some of the promises Trump has made for his first 100 days in office and some of the things he said on the campaign trail through the eyes of these regular people who are expecting some sort of outcome, good or bad. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us just about one or two of these issues that you're going to be looking at in Jacksonville?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the two that feel that they go up against the grain about what America is the issues of immigration. And when he talked about like creating a Muslim registry, like those things, it feels like if we go down those paths, we are changing the fabric of what American society is and what it has been. I think that one thing that gets forgotten in all these conversations is that America is a nation of immigrants. Like nobody, the only people that can claim that they are Native Americans are Native Americans. Like everybody else, like we came over here. And it's really interesting how, if you look at the history, because this isn't new. Like we've had this fight of immigration for, you know, as long as the country's been around. But as soon as like a group gets over here into America, they tend to want to shut the doors and not let other groups in. Mm-hmm. But what the Trump campaign has done is kind of ratcheted those fears way up. And so, you know, I'm looking at, I want to talk to people who agree with Trump, but I also want to talk to people who are worried about it.
Mm. And speaking of worried, we have a comment on our Facebook page from Rana. She says the open Trump campaign hostility aimed at Muslims has influenced attacks and discrimination against our Muslim communities. And as a Muslim American, my fear that the attacks would get even worse. As for my hope, I hope that we use this opportunity as the Muslim community and other minority groups to finally work together, since we share the same fear and the same goal of coexistence. So that's somebody in Jacksonville expressing that fear, and that's a viewpoint we might hear in the episode.
Yeah, it's definitely a viewpoint that you hear in the episode. I think that, you know, everything has become really politicized, but I think that when you hear people talk about their experiences and who they are, and when you begin to understand and know those people, I think, you know, it helps disarm the politicization of an issue. So that's what we're going to be trying to do.
Now, in this episode of Reveal, I'm happy to say that WJCT News is a partner, and we'll hear reporting from Ryan Bank and Lindsay Kilbride. She'll also be working on a piece about school choice under Trump's education secretary pick, Betsy DeVos. Al, you'll be talking to Ryan about his recent reporting on discrimination complaints filed against JEA.
Sure.
How does that fit into this?
Well, I think that, you know, the government, as we know it, or as we have known it, has been set up to protect people, right? Like to make sure that everybody's getting a fair shake. And Trump has nominated Jeff Sessions as his attorney general. And I think that he has a record that we have to keep our eyes on and to make sure that everybody's getting fair treatment. So when you look at like the work that Ryan's done around the EEOC, you're talking about an agency that could possibly be gutted or at least given less power than they already have. You know, at Reveal, we've done a lot of reporting on the EEOC, and mm-hmm. And many of the rules that are in place that govern the EEOC, like, sort of defang it anyway. And so we're in a position now where that could become even worse, where, you know, the people who need help the most will get a cold shoulder from the government. I mean, you know, here's the thing, is that like right now we're looking at like what the world could be. And maybe it doesn't turn out that way. I hope it doesn't turn out that way. But I think that my job as a journalist is to keep people's feet to the fire to make sure that like they're held accountable. So that's kind of where Ryan fits in.
And the Florida Times Union is also partnering with you on this episode. What can we expect to hear from them?
Sure. So the Florida Times Union is doing some work on law enforcement and accountability as well. And, you know, kind of the idea there is that one of the major endorsers of the Trump campaign was the National Union for Police. And so we looked at what they've said that they want to see from Trump and what Trump has said he wants to do. And so we're working on stories that kind of revolve around that idea. Like, what does law enforcement look like under a Trump administration? I mean, you know, Trump was very, very adamant in the fact that he thought that stop and frisk was a good policy, that sure. It worked. Now, you know, just to be really clear, like everything that he said on the campaign trail about stop and frisk is not accurate. When you look at the statistics and the numbers, it's not accurate at all. But he, you know, has a gut feeling that it works. And so he is, you know, championing that idea. And so for me, like, while the president does not set policy, specifically set policy for local law enforcement, if the presidency is setting the tone saying that stop and frisk works, then it gives law enforcement a whole lot more leeway to go out and do these type of searches. And I would say that every American should be worried about that, because our civil liberties say that, like, we all have rights. And if we begin to let those rights erode, then we move into a police state. And I don't think that average citizens want that. And I don't think police officers want that as well.
So policing, just one of several issues that you're going to be looking at in this episode of Reveal. It's going to be airing around the inauguration.
Yep, around the inauguration.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Al Letson, for being here on First Coast Connect.
Thank you for having me in Jacksonville. I love you.
Jacksonville loves you.
I miss you. You're so pretty.
Well, that Jacksonville-centric episode of Reveal, like we just said, will debut right around the time of the presidential election. That's January 20th here on 89.9 WJCT. And there is much more still ahead this hour. Later, we'll hear from the creators of the PBS documentary Meet the Patels. But up next, UF Jacksonville's Trauma One paramedics want to help you stop the bleed and save a life. We'll be back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
The backstory of Donald Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon.
The reason Steve Bannon was hired is because he's a brilliant tactician.
But his tactics have divided and frightened many Americans.
It's white supremacy rebranded under a different name to make it politically palatable.
Who is Steve Bannon really? On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
This week on Jazz Night in America, we ring in the holiday season with the Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra with guest vocalist Denzel Sinclair and Audrey Shakir.
Silent night, holy night.
I'm Christian McBride. That's next time on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
All is bright.
And welcome back. The paramedics with Trauma One want to train more than 1,000 regular people next year to stop life-threatening bleeding. Here now are Trauma One paramedics Chad McIntyre.
Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning. And JD Montgomery is also here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. And so you two know a whole lot about saving lives, right, as trauma paramedics. You're out in helicopters working to save people's lives in this area. And now you want other people to know how to stop the bleed. So, Chad, can you tell us about where Stop the Bleed came from?
Sure. After the Sandy Hook Elementary shootings, there was a group of very intelligent men and women that came together called the Hartford Consensus, and they found that if we would train the public like we did in CPR on how to control bleeding after active shooter events or even after traumatic events, then we would save lives. And the Hartford Consensus has now become Stop the Bleed.
Mm. And why is there the need to train regular people to stop the bleed in those types of situations if you have paramedics there?
So understanding that, especially in a traumatic event and even an active shooter event, that it's going to take time for EMS to get to you. If there is still a threat, then EMS is probably going to be delayed getting access. So what we really want to do is to train the public that if it happens to you or to a loved one or in a place that you can stop the bleeding within minutes, an extremity that has uncontrolled bleeding, a person can die in a matter of minutes, and we want to be able to fix that.
Yeah, and we've heard these stories that are so unfortunate in these types of situations, including like the Pulse shooting in Orlando. We heard about people who they died because of the bleeding,
yes.
Right? And
so the two initiatives that we're really working on is one is to train the public and stop the bleed, give them the tools, give them the education. The other one is tactical emergency casualty care, training EMS to go into areas when it may not be necessarily 100% secure, but how to respond to those.
And what do you mean by not 100% secure?
So if the shooter is not, if it's an active shooter event and they have not been taken into custody, currently most of the policies are that EMS will wait until that has been neutralized. Right now we're really looking at how do we train them to go into an event where the shooter may be in a different part of the building so that we can save lives.
Wow. Now, JD, what do people need to know about bleeding on different parts of the body? What's the most dangerous part to have bleeding?
I'd say the most controllable bleeding is your extremities.
Okay.
You can, your scalp and head bleeding looks bad. But you're really not going to bleed as much as you might with a bad extremity bleed. You got major vessels in there. So that's the easiest controllable bleed is your extremities.
Okay. And what scenarios are most likely to lead to life-threatening bleeding? What are we talking about here that could lead to somebody needing to stop the bleed?
So if you think about, the active shooter event,
right.
If you are, here in Florida, people are outside on boats all the time that get a leg caught in a propeller. Ugh. There's a motor vehicle crash where the arm was mangled. You're up cutting tree limbs and you end up cutting your arm. So it's not just shooting events. There's all traumatic events. And what we really want people to understand is direct pressure. If that's not working, you need to use a tourniquet and get 911 there.
Okay, and can these techniques help somebody save themselves?
Absolutely, yeah. It could be a situation where it is only you, and just knowing the proper techniques of how to stop the bleeding properly could very well save your own life.
So you are the outreach coordinator. You are asking people to come to you and get trained, right, to
yes.
do this. How are you reaching out to people?
We have initially started our train the trainer. So we have started with training our own medical personnel so that we're able to, starting in 2017, go out in the community and train the general public.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like to, if three people will sit down and drink coffee, we'll teach them how to stop bleeding. We want to come to your business associations, to your business meetings, to your organization. If you have 50 minutes, we will come. We will do our song and dance. We'll teach you how to do it. And you can reach us at trauma1@jax.ufl.edu or call JD in his office at 904-244-8515.
And did you say 15 or 50?
50.
50. Okay, so you need about an hour to do the training, and you have this goal of doing or getting 1,000 people next year. Do they have to pay for these courses?
No, they're free. Our chairman of the Department of Surgery, Dr. Lind, has charged all of the residents and faculty and all of Trauma One to go out and train anybody that wants to be trained. And it is free of charge.
So you can offer it maybe as a lunchtime event at your workplace. People will get all these techniques, how to stop the bleed.
Yes.
All right. Anything else that people need to know?
Hopefully you'll reach out to us. We want to train you. The life that you save may be your own.
Thank you. And again, that email address is trauma1@jax.ufl.edu. Thank you very much to J.D. Montgomery and Chad McIntyre.
Thank you, Jessica. Have a happy holiday.
Thank you. You too. And we will be right back in just a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, with the rise of populist leaders in Europe and the election of Donald Trump, some are voicing concerns about the state of liberal democracies, identifying the elements of a stable democracy, and why some nations may be at risk. At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Vince Kong, host of Redux, WJCT's weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. Tune in to catch up on the latest local stories, plus music from our after-hours programming, anytime, anywhere. Subscribe to WJCT Redux now on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back. A documentary airing Monday on WJCT Public Television is about one man's journey to find love. Meet the Patels has been called a real-life My Big Fat Greek Wedding, but it's about a single Indian-American man's quest for love with the help of his traditional family. Here now by phone to talk about making the movie are brother and sister co-directors Ravi and Geeta Patel. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Ravi, audiences might know you from some of your acting work. You've appeared in lots of movies and television shows. Just to list a couple, Grandfathered, Master of None, and Transformers are all on your resume. And you're also the main character in this film, but it's real life. So what inspired you to make a documentary about your own love life?
Well, as you just said, you know, the camera wasn't on me enough. No, I'm kidding. You know, Geeta had just finished making her previous documentary, which is called Project Kashmir, and she spent 8 years making it. It was a more dramatic film about the, you know, war zone in Kashmir. And she had just finished that, and she had bought a camera for herself because she wanted to learn how to use, like, actually use the camera. She hadn't handled it in the last film. So she had it with us on this family trip to India. I was fresh out of a breakup from my white girlfriend, who I'd never told my parents about. And, of course, all they're doing on this trip, as is very normal in the Indian family vacation, they're only talking about getting me married. Like, I was almost 30 years old. It was a code red situation in our family. And we got to India, and it was all people could talk about. And meanwhile, my sister's got this camera on me because she's just trying to figure out how it works.
From there, it's just, you know, you can't stop filming. It was just, Ravi was looking at arranged marriage and our family in such a different way. Like, I'd always cried over it, you know, like, oh my God, we have to marry a Patel. And what am I going to do if I don't fall in love with one? You know, and Ravi was just making jokes and laughing and kind of looking at it in a way that you could actually deal with it more, you know?
I wanted to ask you, Geeta, some reviewers have said that this movie is one of the funniest documentaries they've ever seen. What do you think connects so well with audiences about it?
You know, when you're with your family and you're just laughing uncontrollably, like for a good friend or, you know, an inside joke, like in real life, those moments are so hard to reproduce. They are, you know, moments that we cherish, and when we try to reproduce them or tell somebody the story or turn the camera on and do it again, it's never the same. And the beauty of documentary form is obviously that we try to capture real life, but a lot of times it's hard with comedy because those moments are fleeting. With this particular film, I think what has been awesome is that when Ravi started, you know, kind of doing his, just being himself and just making me laugh about our problems, he was totally uninhibited by the camera. And he wasn't acting and he wasn't pretending. He just really, he's always made me laugh our whole lives. And then when our parents became part of the film and I basically just kept filming because it was a family, you know, it started as a family home video. So nobody had any idea that it'd be in theaters, you know, 8 years later. But at the time, they too were just being themselves. And our family, you know, like Big Fat Creek Wedding, we are just constantly being nuts. And it came completely 100% to life on camera. And I think that humor, as someone who's been in the field for a while, is really hard to capture. And I was blown away by the fact that here in my own home with my own family, they just happen to be able to be themselves 24/7. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's like, it's everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's those moments.
Now, did making this film change the relationship between both of you and with your family?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the, you know, it's been really awesome to see the film be so successful, but I think the biggest impact it's had on our lives has been what it's done for us as a family. And, you know, making a film with your sister is really hard. I mean, making a film, period. I mean, documentaries are thankless jobs. You know, we spent thousands of hours making this movie over the course of like 6 years with zero money. And to this day, we haven't made one penny on it. And yet, so we're making it under very stressful circumstances. And then on top of that, making it with your sister, who you tend to be a little more vulnerable, and, you know, it's easier to get in fights with people you love, ironically. So it was really hard on us. We made each other cry. But as a result of not being able to fire each other, we had to learn to love each other more. And I think respect each other, not only as people, but as filmmakers. And now that the film, you know, the film was released in theaters, and, you know, we were traveling all over the country, not just in theaters, but also film festivals with our parents. And so to experience this all together, it's been like the most incredible once in a lifetime journey. I mean, you should go, my dad is on Facebook now. And if you go on his Facebook page, it's just like, you can like see the transformation, like the impact this has had on his life. I mean, he's just like, he's kind of this like small celebrity now because of this film. And it's just so cute to see a guy who, you know, came here on a student visa and worked as an engineer, an entrepreneur for years and years and years. And here he is in retirement, you know, kind of becoming an artist in front of our eyes as a result of this film. It's really cool.
How did you go from filming a family vacation to the film appearing on PBS?
I had already worked with PBS on my first film. And then when Ravi and I started, kind of, you know, it was just a home video that we brought back from India at that point and looked at, and we thought, God, this is funny. Did anyone else think this is funny? And so, you know, we sort of showed it to PBS and they felt the same way. They're like, oh my God, this is hilarious. Like, you know, and I think we all were just in the beginning curious, and we thought, let's just keep going until they tell us to stop. And so we took a very different process even for making the film with PBS. They really trusted us, because we knew we wanted it to be kind of a form-pushing type of documentary. You know, if anyone has seen it, the documentary is not a typical documentary, I'd say. It has a lot of narrative elements in it, like, kind of stand-up storytelling and animation. And so that was an interesting process. But we never really knew how far it was going to get until it actually was done. And then at that point, it was set to be on PBS if it was good enough. And when it started rocking the festival circuit, we knew that at that point it would have, you know, a great slot at PBS at some point. And we were so excited because it was all a surprise. We honestly just kept our heads down. And I had already been through the documentary process. I knew how hard it was. I knew how you know, you don't expect much except that you created a documentation of something. And I think Ravi and I, that's all we really cared about in the beginning.
Well, I can't wait to see the film. And thank you so much, Ravi and Geeta Patel. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Meet the Patels airs Monday night, December 26th at 10 here on WJCT Public Television. We'll be right back after this break.
When you're experiencing the in-depth content of WJCT, you know there's always something more to explore, regardless of the device. It's a special commitment sharing the world, and as such, WJCT is an indispensable service here on the First Coast. Truth is, however, that such content, whether you access it via television, radio, or various digital platforms, is expensive. Costs that are largely funded by people like you. So please, during this season of giving, stand up now for your cherished values of curiosity and excellence with your vital year-end investment. Your support makes it possible for WJCT to continue to share your community, your world. Do so today at WJCT.org. Thank you.
Welcome back. And finally this hour, AARP has about 125,000 members in Jacksonville. Here to tell us what's in store for all of them in 2017 is Field Coordinator Justine Conley. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Thank you. And first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and what do you do for AARP in Jacksonville?
Well, we don't have that much time to talk about me, but I am from North Carolina. Came to Florida in the 80s with a ministry, a full-time ministry job that I loved and worked with teenagers. And from there, they sent me to Chicago. And then I left that organization in Chicago in the 2005, 2006 and found myself trying to decide what else I wanted to do. And I grew up. So I became a life coach and did some training and have always had a heart for the community. So when I came back to Florida to have my sisters take care of me after some surgery, had no plans to stay in Jacksonville, but I'd lived here before and things happened. And
it's funny how that happens. It happened to me too.
See, okay.
All right.
And so I got to reimagine my life, and AARP has a program called Life Reimagined. Uh-huh. And so I am living the Life Reimagined dream as the field coordinator. I applied for this job, was in the process for a few months, and they brought me on as the Associate State Director, Field Coordinator for Jacksonville.
Okay. So as part of that, you are involved in Career Day. That's coming up in February.
Let me go back for a second. AARP has so many programs.
Okay.
And we are about people 50 plus living their best lives.
Okay.
And so how do they embrace real possibilities? And so one of the ways is with employment. And so a lot of people are working longer, staying in the workforce longer, and are loving what they do. But many people find themselves unemployed after 50. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that when a person 55 plus, according to the Pew organization, talks about when a person loses their job after 55, that they're a year longer into the process, 44% have trouble after a year still finding a job.
Okay.
So AARP, of course, 50 plus and Real Possibilities, are doing a career day. And we do work after 50. We do classes, training, resumes. We do a lot of different things. So here at WJCT, this is where our office is, we'll be doing a career day. The career day is going to be Thursday, February
16th.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I always get that date. But February 16th, and it's from 9 until 1. I want to quickly tell you just a couple things we're going to have in that day. Bring your resume. We're going to have your resume looked at. Come dressed, ready for success. We're going to have your look updated. Then we're going to have a Life Reimagined checkup. Have you look at how do you best look at what's next.
Okay.
And then we're going to have an actual employers here as well.
Okay. Employer is here as well. That's important.
Yes.
So you can actually talk to the people who might be giving you a job.
Yes.
Okay.
Bring resumes.
Bring those resumes. And that is WJCT's building here,
yes.
February 16th. If people want to sign up or get involved in AARP, where should they go?
AARP.org/Jacksonville. AARP.org/Jacksonville.
And it's AARP, not just for retirees. It's for people who are looking.
50 plus.
Yeah.
And many people are still in the workplace and still vibrant and still have a whole life ahead of them.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Justine Conley, for being here.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And that is our show. And thank you to all of our guests and our callers this morning. Our producer is Kevin Merschart, and Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme song is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes. Next on the Diane Rehm Show, with the rise of populist leaders in Europe and the election of Donald Trump, some are voicing concerns about the fate of liberal democracies. Diane's guests identify the elements of a stable democracy and nations that could be at risk. That's next. I'm Jessica Palumbo, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville, your community, your world. Ryan Benk will be here tomorrow morning with the last show of 2016. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.